racism, sexism, and those kinds of problems would go away. That won't happen because that's built into our society. We have to daily work to change that. I just think that this begins a step towards doing that, but it won't guarantee solving that very important problem. But you might look at those to see that from county to county, how remand is used. And remember, this is only on 16 and 17 year olds and no relationship to the degree of crime that they are accused of. Thank you very much.
Okay, I think that concludes the questions. Thank you again for your excellent presentation and for the materials. I'm going to follow the sign-up sheet. I know there are several individuals who have also been invited to testify, so I'm working off two sheets, and I think I will have everyone covered. Next individual who has signed up is Lawrence Matazar.
Good afternoon. I'm a lawyer in Portland, and I submitted some written testimony to Chairperson Springer. And I'm not going to go into that except to say that, first of all, I see this not as a remand bill. I think everybody, most of the people that are going to talk today are going to discuss the issue in the bill concerning the reduction of the remand age to 14. I'm talking about a very small portion of the bill, that portion that would prohibit the death penalty as applied to juveniles and would also prohibit minimum sentences. In my written testimony, I talk a little bit about some of the psychological and social scientific testimony, and I'm sorry, data concerning adolescence. I'm not going to talk about that here. One thing I do think that's important to reiterate, and that is that nearly all of the civilized world prohibits the death penalty applied to juveniles. Even such countries as South Africa, the Soviet Union, and Northern Ireland, all those countries prohibit the death penalty applied to juveniles under 18. Another thing I think is important is the fact that the death penalty is a reality in Oregon as applied to juveniles. I currently represent a 17-year-old boy charged with aggravated murder in a case where he's got pretty much no criminal record, is negligible. He has what they call a conditional postponement on a burglary too, a very minor incident. That's the only prior adjudication he has. It's a case where the juvenile court counselor, they assigned the case to a special experienced juvenile court counselor. He recommended even against remand. The court hired their own psychologist, not just the defense psychologist, but the court hired its own psychologist, and that psychologist recommended against remand. And yet, this child is facing the death penalty in Oregon. Another important factor is that the death penalty, and I don't think this is the time to go into a comprehensive discussion about the death penalty in general. Yet, everyone who has studied the question from the U.S. Supreme Court on down says that the procedures are very imperfect. It's practically freakish. At a conference in January in Portland, Millard Farmer, a well-known attorney who handles many, many death penalty cases from team defense in Georgia, talked about cases where the co-defendants in a capital homicide case, one of them is alive and the other is dead. One of them is on the street. There are many cases where one of the co-defendants are on the street, the other has been executed solely because of just small technical errors made by their lawyers or made somewhere along the line. It's a freakish penalty. In fact, in my research, I just located today a case in Oregon. The last juvenile executed in Oregon was 1942, hardly the Stone Age, and yet, for some reason, and I haven't been able to find out, that case was never even appealed. It's one of the few Oregon death penalty cases where people were actually executed, where there was, for some reason, we don't know what, there was simply no appeal. It's another thing, as Senator Riles just indicated, the legislature is often concerned with line drawing. That's why, because in this situation, it's either the legislative decision or we're left with juries to determine whether or not particular juveniles get executed. In making your legislative decision, I think it's important to understand While we have had this referendum that was passed last election in November, where the citizens voted in favor of the death penalty, what I could tell, a most recent article I saw was the University of Florida Law Review study in 1983, which says that surveying many public opinion surveys, not necessarily in Oregon, but it says according to recent public opinion surveys, most citizens favor the retention of capital punishment in general, but oppose its infliction on juveniles. So it's important to separate what the question was before the people of Oregon in November versus what this bill does. I urge you to act. This is the kind of situation that there's another case besides mine in Oregon, in Multnomah County. I don't know what other ones there are in the rest of the state, but there's another aggravated murder case. It could be in Washington County. It's a situation where it's a reality. It could happen within 2 years, and it appears that whatever the disagreements that there may be about the other factors in this bill, that I think we all could agree, Senator Riles has indicated her support for this aspect of the bill, and everyone could agree that this committee should at least pass that section which would prohibit the imposition of the death penalty on juveniles. It's section 7. It's on pages 38 and 39 of page 2 of Senate Bill 414 that I have. It would amend section 7. It simply says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, disposition as an adult of a child remanded under this section shall not include application of a sentence of death or any minimum sentence. And I'd ask this committee to at least pass that portion of the bill.
Okay, that is section 9, I believe, of the engrossed printed bill we have, page 5, lines 13 through 15.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Manazar, I didn't understand correctly. Did you have additional written comments you were going to submit? Or?
Well, I had submitted a letter. I was kind of caught by surprise as far as the specific date for this hearing. So I could submit. I think you already have a...
I have a letter.
That's not it. I sent a letter to you, must have been a week or so ago, and I received a telephone call in response, so okay. I'm sure somebody has it. So okay. If you could maybe reproduce it.
May 20th? Okay.
Have my testimony?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Can I get that letter back?
Sure.
Mr. Chairman? Thank you. We don't want this in the...
Need not be made part of the record. Okay, are there any questions for Mr. Manazar? We'll make sure all members have a copy of your letter. It should be part of the packet of information we have. Thank you. Claudia Burton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon, representing the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. I am a law professor at Willamette, though obviously not speaking for Willamette today, and I've represented ACLU on bills affecting juveniles since the 73 session, off and on. First, in response to the point that Representative Phillips raised with respect to whether or not there is a pattern on remand of youngsters in Oregon. And the study that was released in March of 85 by the Crime Analysis Center, that Jim Huser, if he's here, may speak to later, on those children remanded to adult courts for serious felonies, Part 1 felonies in 1980. That's the group that was looked at. There were some 99 young people so remanded. Of those, 90% were white, 4% black, 4% Hispanic, and 3% Indian. So you can, that's 90, 4, 4, 3. They mount up to 101, which I didn't understand, but In any event, that's on page 12 of Jim Huser's report.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there are parts of Senate Bill 414 which we do support, most particularly the point just covered by Mr. Matisar. However, on balance, we strongly oppose the bill. And that's not because there are not positive parts to it, but because we are deeply troubled at the notion of holding youngsters of 15, let alone 14, fully responsible for their delinquent acts. For us, the gut question is, when does a person become an adult? When are they mature enough? Do they have the judgment, the ability to control impulses, the ability to say no to their peers? That degree of maturity, that makes it fair to hold them to adult standards. We do not consider young people of 14 to be adults for any other purpose in the state of Oregon. They don't vote. They can't marry. They can't have access to alcohol. They don't serve on juries. They can't be emancipated. They can't withdraw from school. And that's a flat rule. We don't have an individualized determination of the maturity of that kid. We just assume that a person under those ages simply does not have the judgment and maturity to carry either that right or that responsibility. And it seems quite incongruous to us to hold in this one area only the youngster to the consequences of his conduct under the adult criminal system. Rather than going through the beginning of my testimony, which gives you some information, much of which was covered by Senator Riles about the use of remand in Oregon, I'd like to switch, if I could, to the bottom of page 3 and then on for some specific recommendations that we would make with respect to this bill. First of all, and I'll go ahead and say it, we would oppose lowering the age of remand at all. On the other hand, if the committee has decided that it wishes to take that step, then we have, at the top of page 4, two suggestions, and I really ask you to consider these carefully. One, really consider whether you want to go all the way to 14, or whether 15 would do it. 14 is really unusually low, looked at from national standards. And I have doubts about how mature 15-year-olds are, and those doubts are much stronger for 14-year-olds. Second recommendation, which I would urge strongly, I would urge you to consider limiting the offenses for which people in that age group could be remanded to murder alone. And I've got a real simple reason for that. I assume that the primary reason behind this bill, which I understand, is the desire to be able to have a hold on certain quite dangerous youngsters past the age of 21. That's really, I think, the major motivation for this bill, the expunction business in addition, but primarily, I think, to hold the kid past 21. On the very last page of my testimony, as Appendix C, I have attached the matrix that the parole board presently uses. I notice in the audience that Chalmers Jones is here from the parole board, and I sure hope that you direct any specific questions about this to him rather than to me. But what I did with this matrix and the regulations that accompany it was to go through the calculation of the history risk score and make judgments as to what a young person remanded at the age of 14 or 15 would be likely to have in terms of a background. And my judgment, and I'd be happy to go into it in more detail if anybody had the time or interest, is that most people would have a history risk score of at least 6. That means if you look at this matrix, only for Category 7 do you have a time to be served that will take you past that 15-year-old and 11-month or 16-year-old's 21st birthday. The times, the longest one there for Category 6 for the good history risk score is 56 months. That's less than 5 years. That means, under this matrix, the kid's out before his 21st birthday. Well, you can hold a kid in the juvenile system to their 21st birthday. Now, I should say that this matrix does not hold for all. It may be varied upon the agreement of a supermajority of the parole board, and in addition, you stack the matrix if you have 2 offenses committed at the same time and the sentences are ordered consecutively rather than concurrently. But this is the general format, and under this general format, only 16-year-olds and youngers and younger who are accused of murder would, under the matrix, serve past their 21st birthday. Those are our 2 suggestions for the 14 and 15-year-olds. We have a suggestion for the 16 and 17-year-olds as well. Senator Riles alluded to the degree to which Oregon uses remand. It uses it a lot. Of the 37 jurisdictions in this country that in 1978 used our system, namely criminal responsibility at age 18, and for younger than that, a judicial waiver or remand system. Out of those 37 jurisdictions, Oregon had the highest remand rate in the entire country. It was 4 times the national average. And if you looked at the offenses for which these kids are remanded, it was not crimes involving serious physical violence, for the most part. Only 6% of the youngsters remanded were remanded on offenses of that nature. For that matter, looking at the dispositions, fully 75% of the youngsters who were remanded received what? Fine or probation, that's all. So we are, in our opinion, remanding hundreds of kids presently for whom there simply is no need. For a while, until really fairly recently, the dispositional alternatives in the juvenile court were quite limited. The court basically could put the kid on probation or send him to McLaren without a whole lot in between. Out of home care, but that becomes a little silly maybe for an 18 or 19 year old. Not a 19, a 17 or 18 year old. Let me back up again. 16 or 17 year old, I'll get it right eventually. Recently, though, in the last several sessions, this legislature has added to the juvenile court's dispositional arsenal fines, restitution, costs, community service. Now, if you add those to the other dispositional alternatives that we had, it seemed to me that there's no excuse for not treating the great bulk of those 16 and 17-year-olds presently remanded in the juvenile court. And I would suggest that this committee limit the class of offenses to take your pick. I would recommend Class A or Class A and B felonies. Those are the serious ones for which the arguably the adult criminal sanctions are appropriate. Next, there are a few procedural matters that I would direct your attention to. And they're contained on pages 4 through 6.
May I just interrupt with a question?
Certainly.
I think it may be appropriate at this last suggestion where you, I believe, want to limit the range of offenses for remand of 16 and 17-year-olds to the A and B felonies. Is that a rough approximation?
Mm-hmm.
What about the blanket remand that applies to, and this is maybe a technical issue, but the blanket remand that generally applies to traffic offenses or traffic crimes such as DUI or attempt to elude may not be a problem necessarily. I don't know if it is or not, but
I'm just aware of one category where I think most counties have that kind of provision in effect.
I believe they do, Mr. Chairman, and I simply haven't carefully thought out the blanket remand. My recommendations are with respect to the individualized judicial remand.
If you have some further thoughts on them, want to share them with us later or, you know, in writing or whatever, I appreciate the theory.
Thank you.
Okay.
On the procedural things, let me first focus on the judge and what the judge's role might be in this process. Under the provisions as they currently stand, there is nothing to prevent the judge initiating the remand motion. But then the judge would conduct the hearing and make the decision as to whether or not the child should be remanded. We don't think that's appropriate. How can someone who is the moving party on it then be impartial? And we would suggest that the statute specify that only the district attorney or the child may move. Secondly, there is no provision that specifies that the judge who presided at the remand shall not preside at the subsequent adjudication on the merits, whether it's in juvenile court or if the child is remanded in the adult court. Well, a very great deal of information comes in a remand hearing that is not admissible in an adjudicatory hearing. The kid's prior record, for example. Any social history, for example. The previous experience within the juvenile court, for example. And that sort of information could potentially be quite prejudicial to the child, and we would recommend that the child may disqualify the child's option, the judge who presided at remand from presiding at a later trial on the merits. With respect to burden of proof, we suggest changing it from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing. Our reasons simply are that this is an extremely serious decision for the child. Other similarly, in our opinion, serious decisions call for that level of proof. When you are terminating parental rights, when you are having a civil commitment, those two must be by clear and convincing, and we think it would be appropriate here. We then had two suggestions on revising the criteria for remand. On protection required by the community, we absolutely would agree that that is an extremely legitimate concern. I think it's probably the thing of greatest concern to a lot of people. We would simply define it more clearly, at least in our opinion, more clearly. The second one is of a little different nature. The prosecutive merit of the case is the language in the bill. We would urge you to change that to a requirement that probable cause that the offense was committed be proven, particularly in the case of the 14 and 15-year-olds, because understand what can happen. If the 14 or 15-year-old is charged with one of the offenses listed in the bill, then if he's alleged or she to have committed any other offenses at the same time, the kid is remanded on all of them. And he stays in adult court even if the original remandable offense is found not proven. Well, that clearly presents the potential for abuse. And we think if you don't want to eliminate that provision altogether, which we would favor, that at a minimum you ought to require the probable cause be established in the remand hearing that the youngster in fact committed that offense. The last two suggestions have to do with the use of the child's testimony, and I think that's pretty straightforward. And then lastly, at the bottom of page 6, the issue of kids in jails. As some of you may know, 3 years ago, the Juvenile Rights Project prevailed in a case involving Columbia County and the practice of incarcerating kids in jails. The court there held that that practice violated due process. Now, it excluded from that kids have been remanded, and it excluded kids being held briefly for identification purposes. There is, but the bill, the statute has never been amended to reflect that decision. There is a bill currently in the legislature, 2046, that would make that change. It is partly through the process now, but not all the way through. I would urge you to conform this bill, assuming it's going to pass out, conform this bill to 2046. I don't believe that there is controversy on that point. Lastly, and very briefly and a little apologetically, speaking to the matter of bringing up all of these things at this late stage of the proceedings, I'm apologetic about that, and we really ought to have mentioned them earlier. I wish that we had. We didn't. On the other hand, the second house is there for a purpose, and conference committees are there for a purpose. My judgment is that there is probably on both sides of the House, that is both Senate and House, sufficient support for this bill that the bill going through is not a problem. And I do not believe that taking a few extra days to make the changes that I suggested, assuming you agreed with them, would jeopardize the bill if your chief intention is to get some bill out. I've attached as appendices to the testimony a copy of an issue study done 2 years ago by the Newman Project that summarizes remand in Oregon and that 78 study that I mentioned to you. I've also included as Appendix B a sheet of paper put out by the Crime Analysis Center in March of 85 that indicates, interestingly enough, that contrary to popular perception of an increase in the number of crimes, violent crimes committed by juveniles, there has in fact been a decrease in absolute numbers of 20% over the last 10 years. I called Portland State's Center for Population Research and Census to see what kind of population change there might have been during that period. They didn't have population groupings that directly corresponded to this. Theirs was 4 to 20, but for that age group, the drop was only 4%. So I think that that probably is a genuine drop, that 20%. The one figure that looks bad is aggravated assault. It is an increase. On the other hand, if you examine the data for the same period of time for adults, it's not given anything to kids, whereas it was going up some 67% for the adults, it was going up 200 to 250% for adults. So apparently you just simply had something going on in society at that point. Kids were subject to it in part, and adults even more. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for allowing me this time.
Okay. Ms. Burton, thank you also for the excellent presentation of the issues and for the materials you've submitted. Are there any questions? Representative Miller.
A couple of great ones. When you refer to the we, I assume it's the American Civil Liberties Union that proposed this. How do you gauge that the whole organization is opposed to it? Do you have an executive committee that you talk to, or who made the decision that you opposed this bill as it is?
It's a twofold process, Representative Miller. Policy for the organization as a whole is set by our board of directors, which is, I think, a 27-person body selected from or elected from the state of Oregon. We then have a legislative committee that's composed partly of board members, partly of non-board members, and they make recommendations on specific bills consistent with established policy. And if a bill arises that is not within policy, not either way, pro or con, they then take it to the board for that decision. So that's our basic process.
So there were at least 27 folks who said they didn't like this, or it's a majority of those 27, or am I?
Would have been a majority of the persons present at the board meeting where we considered the question.
Do you recall whether it was unanimous or not?
No, I'm sorry, I don't. I have a file that goes back a ways because, as Senator Riles and others of you may know, this is an issue that's gone back a ways. And I found, I think, a 1973 memo in my file that was from a subcommittee of us reporting to the board. And I don't recall what the vote was in 73 on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
Tim Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question, Claudia, that I have for you is for when a juvenile has been convicted of a crime, subsequently released at age 21, Do you have any figures on the recidivism of those people?
I'm sorry, Representative Hill, I don't.
Thank you.
Okay, I think that's a question that I was also considering, and hopefully maybe someone here, if anyone can supply that information, which you'd like to get it, and maybe council can also try to pursue that. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Ms. Burton. Okay. Again, if anyone's got a time crunch, we do have about 8 more people signed up. I don't know if the rest of the testimony of Representative Kopetsky, do you want to be recognized, or do you have a time crunch?
I have a
time
crunch.
I do. Yeah. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee. If anyone does have a time problem, please let me know. Yes, ma'am? Would you like to come up and testify now? Okay, Ms. Johnson. I don't know if all the testimony is going to be quite as lengthy as these initial presentations. I don't want to cut anybody off, but I do want to make sure that everyone gets an opportunity at a reasonable time. And also, we do have other bills we're working on this afternoon. Ms. Johnson, if there is anyone... That